Good afternoon, and welcome to another conversation here at the First Things podcast. Today, we have with us Peter Meyer, a journalist, a former news editor at Life magazine, and at Education Next, a prominent education periodical out of Harvard. And he is now managing editor of Paideia Times, a news aggregator for college leaders. He's also the founder of School Life Media. He is with us today to speak about education and religious schools, particularly Catholic schools. He was the author of some important articles a few years ago, one called Can Catholic Schools Be Saved? That was from 2007. We'll hear if you have an answer to that question.
It's already been 10 years.
10 years, so maybe we'll be able to weigh in on some evidence. He also had a story from 2011 where he closely chronicled a couple of charter schools in Chicago opened by the Christian Brothers. Welcome, Peter. Glad to have you.
Glad to be here, Mark.
Very good. Well, let me ask the obvious first question. What got you interested in Catholic schools as a journalist?
I went to Catholic schools. I grew up Catholic. And not only did I go to Catholic schools in grade school, but after I graduated in eighth grade and had my first dance at eighth grade graduation, there was with the nuns hanging around forcing us to touch a girl in dance, I ran right off to the Catholic seminary with the Benedictines. So I then spent 4 years on a hilltop at Mount Angel, Oregon, beautiful place, where in the library the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue was censored. There you go.
I approve.
There you go.
So I like that idea of the nuns. I have a 12-year-old son, and I sometimes wish that he was in a school where the seats were all nailed to the floor and the nuns were walking back and forth in the aisle with a ruler in their hands. But we don't have that anymore, I guess.
It's funny because I visited in one of these Catholic school stories I did for Education Next. I visited a school in Brooklyn, a former Catholic school, and it was still owned by the Brooklyn Diocese, but used less frequently. But I was given the tour, and the woman giving me the tour asked if I knew what those holes in the floors were. And I said, no. She said, that's when they nailed the desks to the floor. Right. They had 60 kids in this room.
All facing in the same direction, all lined up.
And
that's right, that's right. Yeah. Well, I entered middle school in 1973, I guess, right at the time of the open classroom experiment. I'd gone from a traditional elementary school, and this was a new school outside Washington, D.C. as a public school. The open classroom, so you could rearrange the chairs any way you wanted. There were other classrooms nearby, no walls, big open space, and I guess this was supposed to give us a feel of freedom and openness.
Yes.
Amidst all of our lessons in the communicative property and the Pythagorean theorem. Didn't quite get the relationship. It didn't last long, did it?
No, actually, it did last a long time. I've visited hundreds of classrooms, public school classrooms, and I'm still amazed that they seat kids in circles, you know, and it's not the open classroom that you're describing in that you had multiple classrooms nearby, but they do the same things within a classroom where I call it classroom architecture. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was introduced to one of those classrooms times four, because I'm part of what I do for School Life Media is teach journalism to kids. And I had a bunch of fifth graders we just started with this year, and the last moment they decided to combine two classes. So I had 53 kids in this
fifth
class.
Fifth graders.
And I thought they were doing it to punish me because I used to be a critic of, I was on the school board at this school district, and I was quite a critic of school teaching and teachers, and I thought that they did this on purpose because I had at least 20 kids sitting on the floor.
That's right, Meyer. Let's see how you can handle things.
Right, exactly.
So you can know what we're up against.
Little did they know that I'm a journalist, and I've been in war zones, and I've been in Democratic conventions and Republican conventions. This was just red meat for me, and I had a great time. But the teachers finally cried uncle. And we're back to regular classrooms.
What was it about the Catholic middle schools and high school the seminary that stand out for you today? How old are you now, if I may ask?
I'm older than you because I graduated from high school in 68.
Okay.
So that meant I grew up probably in what can be described as a heyday of Catholic education. I mean, literally, we were in the 60s, Catholic schools were educating one out of eight kids in America, the K-12. One out of every eight people in America were being educated by Catholics. And that came about only because of, it came about, it's a very rich history, the Catholic schools, but it's to sum it up, I lead my education next story about saving Catholic schools with a little conversation I had much later when my son was going to a public school in upstate New York, and I was outside the school talking to a friend of mine, and we were both complaining about what was going on in the school and how terrible our kids' educations were, and Bobby stopped and he says, you know, there's nothing wrong with this school that a busload of nuns couldn't fix.
And so, you believe that?
And I definitely believe that. And you know, there's a wonderful book. It's sort of plenty has been written about Catholic schools. James Coleman, the famous sociologist, did studies that show how effective Catholic schools were. Andrew Greeley, the famous Catholic sociologist, wrote about Catholic schools in a very research-oriented and scientific way, showing how they were doing a much better job at teaching kids than public schools. And then, I'm blanking on his name, but there was a 1990, I can remember the year when this big study came out by, I think the fellow helped me with, he's at the heading up the Carnegie Institute, I think. But in any case, it was called Catholic Schools and the Common Good. And this was a huge study of Catholic schools, and it basically came to the conclusions that Catholic schools did a much better job of educating poor kids, black kids, all of the sort of so-called diversity that public schools speak a lot about now. The conclusion of this study was that Catholic schools actually did it. And they did it in part because they had a constrained curriculum.
Huh. Well, before you said that, I was going to assume that something about the Catholic vision, the theocentric humanism of Catholicism was serving as a human glue for all different kinds. I mean, this is one of the things that strikes me about the Catholic Church. You line up for communion, you sit in the pews, and it is a mingling of all different kinds of people, and there is no differentiation during that. And I wonder if this is one of the things that the Catholic schools might have been able to provide, was a form of unity that would underlie all the diversity that the public schools can't really provide. I mean, what is the unity underlying the diversity in a public school? Where do they go in order to say we are all one? Or do they say, no, we can't say that. We will not say that, in fact.
I agree with you completely. And that's probably a huge problem. It's one reason why E.D. Hirsch, you know, with his core knowledge and cultural literacy, has trying to bring back a kind of unity of curriculum, which is, I think, one of the things you're getting at with talking about the unity in the Catholic Church. It's not just a unity of theology. And I think one of the surprising things about what these guys in the 90s discovered was that there wasn't any secret to their success in the curriculum. That surprised me when I read that. It was more the discipline and order that was provided by the single vision, I think, what you're talking about. But it wasn't a single vision of curriculum. And this is where the nuns come in, because the nuns were a teaching establishment, an organization, if you will. There was something like 180,000 nuns working in Catholic schools at that. We're talking about the 60s, back to the mm-hmm. high point. Mm-hmm. And that provided what these guys, Anthony Brick, the main author of that study, Anthony mm-hmm. Brick. Mm-hmm. What they discovered was it was the cohesion that came around cohesive management. Catholics, as you know, have a sort of a term called subsidiarity. So everyone thinks that the Pope gives orders and all Catholics march to the order. And that is only true for certain, you know, theological issues, and usually they're big issues. But otherwise, the Catholic Church runs at a parish level and in a remarkably decentralized way. Hmm. And it's a secret that's really hard to put your finger on, but it has to do with sort of a vision that they obviously have and a theology that they obviously have. But that vision and theology and the way it was implemented through nuns who were like some of the most disciplined and ordered people mm-hmm. that we met, implemented this and made it come true, and that's what I think was part of the secret to the success of the Catholic schools.
One of our contributors, the poet Dana Gioia, yeah. actually attributes much of his humanistic success in life in the literary and cultural spheres to the nuns in the Catholic school that he attended. He actually has openly thanked the nuns yes. for giving him the base, the foundation that enabled him to go to Stanford and then Harvard, as the first kid in his family actually to go to college.
Nuns, as with priests, I mean, I went to a Benedictine seminary in high school, and all of my teachers were PhDs, right? So in high school, and so you've got to credit, and this is one of the things, I think one of the secrets to the Catholic success, they do believe in education. I mean, and they train their priests well. In the past, they trained their nuns well. I mean, our principal, my principal at St. Joseph's Elementary School in Salem, Oregon, was a former rodeo queen. Right, so she knew how to swing a paddle when need be, but she was also was very well educated, and so as were all of the nuns and the priests.
So Peter, you're talking about the mid '60s, extraordinary high point. In 2007, you're talking about whether the schools can survive.
Well, yeah, and they because. As Brick's book, 1990, came out just as the Catholic school system was beginning to feel the pain, the hit, if you will, of the loss of nuns. I mean, this incredible defection by women that wanted to be priests. They just didn't exist. So that was the first thing that the Catholics got hit by. Probably a second thing, which was sort of felt more later, was charter schools. I mean, I can't tell you how many charter schools I've visited over the years. I walk into the school and I go, wow, this reminds me of Catholic schools. You know, the uniforms, stand and line up in lines, a teacher who stood in the front of a classroom that with desks lined up, all of those things. So it had, I think those two, the loss of the nuns and the charter schools, had an enormous impact on Catholic schools.
So a lot of parents who were looking at Catholic schools mostly for order and tight education, they now had competition from the charters.
And you can't deny, I mean, that going on simultaneously with this is priest abuse.
Right.
I mean, child abuse. I was in the Time Magazine newsroom with all the TV monitors, you know, in Rockefeller Center, and I looked up as I was going across the room, and I saw, I saw there's Father Gary, guy that I'd gone to seminary with. And then as soon as I said that, underneath was the little banner that said, arrested in Chicago. So, I mean, this was a guy I went to school with, and he was abusing kids, and he served 8 years in jail for it. I lost a Disney movie deal because of this. I wrote a story for Life magazine about a day in the life of, and I profiled a Catholic priest and a parish in Chicago, right? And it was terrific. Everybody loved it. And as soon as it came out, I got a call from Disney. They wanted to make it. This is 1990. It's hard to imagine that these idyllic Mickey Mouse years were still, you know, in existence. And they wanted to make a movie out of this priest's life in a parish. And I literally, about 2 days after I had this conversation, big headlines in the Chicago papers was that they arrested a couple priests for sex abuse, one of whom was actually in the parish that I was profiling. Mm-hmm. Right? So that did not help the Catholic Church, and a number of people have been noticing the loss of religiosity in general. It has hurt the Catholic Church, even though nominally there's more Catholics than ever. There's fewer and fewer Catholic schools, so it's been a big hit that they've taken on several fronts. So that by the time I was dispatched to write that story for Education Next, Catholic schools were hurting. And so it's been interesting to watch what's happened since 2007, because a lot of strides have been made to bring Catholic schools back, and we could talk about that later. But
that's probably what a lot of listeners are curious about. Since 2007, does the picture look better nationally or in different localities? Does it look better?
I don't know the statistics. I'll be the first to admit I'm not sure the statistics. I don't think. From a statistical, I think they're still struggling, Catholic schools, but you will find the promising trends that have started are tax credits, for instance, that I think Florida has. New York keeps trying to pass a tax credit that will allow people to donate to Catholic schools and take a tax credit. That sort of is a hugely, potentially life-saving issue when it comes to saving Catholic schools, right? They don't have, the Christian Brothers experiment was an interesting one, because that was Arne Duncan when he was head of.
These are the charter schools that started in Chicago in what year?
This was back in the where am I?
Roughly.
Where am I? When was Arne? When Obama? So late. It was like the early 2000s.
Okay.
So I did that story. Well, that story actually came out in 2011. So it was Arne Duncan had just before he went to D.C. with Obama. Mm-hmm. He tapped on the, and he was considered a reformer superintendent, Chicago
right.
schools, got right. lots of good creds.
Right.
But he actually came to the Christian Brothers and they said, will you guys start a couple charter schools, which is sort of.
Really?
Yes.
This is a question. Could they keep the crucifixes in
no.
the classroom and still be charters?
No.
No.
So they had to.
You still can't. Is there any chance that that separation will ever be overcome?
You know, it's a great question. And when I was doing the historical research on this piece, I went back to the early 17th century, 18th century New York City. At the time, the New York City government was handing out money to Catholic schools all over the place, just because they there wasn't the separation in church and state that you, or it wasn't the same kind of. But now it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to maintain anything resembling a separation that would be meaningful to Catholics. About my fourth day in this, the charter school in Chicago, run by the Christian Brothers, I was called. I was walking down a hallway, and this teacher called me into his room. It was empty. It was after school, and this was a guy. They had a lot of, I forgot what the a lot of priests are former brothers. They have brothers as the step down from priesthood. So the Christian Brothers, because of its worldwide connections, were using a lot of brothers from Africa. And this guy pulled me into the room. He says, "Please, I have to talk to you. I have to talk to you. I have to tell you. They're not telling you this." He was speaking in a whisper, because what he was essentially saying is what you just asked about. They don't have God. They can't have God here, and that is not helping these students. So, so there you have it. Is it
could they teach? Could they teach Bible, historic as a historical and literary artifact?
They taught. There's a and I can't. I'm blanking on the name. There was a character education program, which was sort of, you know, it's a variation of the Boy Scout, you know, model. We shall be, you know, don't lie, don't cheat, and blah blah blah. Yeah, but not, but the religious part, the God part, even in out of the, they could do the Bible. Yes, they could read from the Bible, but not in any. But they couldn't make any allusions to this being our. They weren't supposed to. I don't know.
Well,
I, you know,
well, I think Peter, the restraint is a lot stronger than that. I mean, things like you can't have religious questions on standardized tests.
Right. I believe it.
It could trigger. It could disadvantage secular students. So, and you know, if it's not tested, it isn't taught in public schools. And also, I think school boards, you know, approving schools, approving curricula, they just see religion means trouble, right? Religion means complication, and they're not even anti-religious. But they don't want trouble,
right?
And so we find that, in my opinion, students who come through the humanistic disciplines in the public schools are half educated because they don't study religion.
One of my favorite questions that I was asking for a number of years when I talked to educators was, "Would you like your plumber to be able to quote Shakespeare?" And the obvious thing, the reason I ask that question is, how do we get back a
You want them to
humanist,
be taught Shakespeare
how do you
in high school.
Yeah. Right. And I first tested this question in a task force that I had in my little school district when I was on the board. And I mean, to a person, and this was 12 people, several teachers, parents, to a person, they said no.
Why not?
And including teachers, no way. I want him to know plumbing. So that launched my then. I've asked that question to David Steiner and to David Coleman. I'm surprised I haven't asked you yet, but my favorite answer
I think
was,
everybody should be able to quote Shakespeare.
There Peter. You go. Tell me why.
Why?
Yes.
Because everyone deserves it.
Why do they? So what is it? So here's. Let me give you. Who's President of Bard? I'm blanking on. President of Bard.
Leon
Botstein. Yes.
Botstein.
So, who I have an enormous respect for, and in part because Ted Koppel used to have Botstein on Nightline. When you knew he was trying to fill some space with an educated person, and Botstein is one of the few intellectuals that could talk in full sentences and make people laugh and smile, including time. Anyway,
well, he is a conductor too.
He is a conductor.
So
yes.
that helps you handle the camera and the interview.
He's very good.
And
so when I was interviewing him for a piece on early college education, which is a whole and fascinating subject, and it's. I left Education Next without finishing the story. It's a blotch on my record. But I asked Botstein the question about Shakespeare and plumbers and his plumber. And he looked at me and he says, "Well, he would be a happier plumber."
I'm not sure I would agree that he'd be a happier plumber, but I would say that he has a richer experience of life, which isn't always a guarantee of happiness, but it is a fuller.
I think he might have, he would, happiness in the sort of the 18th century Enlightenment.
Okay.
You know, truth, what's our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? That was, I think, Botstein, if you've never read Jefferson's Children, I recommend it. It's a Botstein's book about education, and he covers a wide range of material, including how to, including this early college, high school, and where he sort of hatched the idea there. But
I want my plumber to be able to quote Shakespeare, and I want him to be able to quote from the Psalms. I want him to be able to quote from the Sermon on the Mount. I want him to be able to be someone who enjoyed an instruction that endowed him with a bit of humanitas, and because he deserves it, and everyone deserves it.
But the assumption that you're making, this is what I'm going to, I'll try and get you to if I was interviewing you for a story. Why do they deserve it? What is it that makes a liberal arts education or a humanities education, and assume for a minute that it includes Shakespeare and St. Augustine, et cetera, what is it about reading those people and learning about their lives that makes one a, quote, better or happier person than that?
Peter, I don't take that step in terms of justifying those materials, in terms of what they do for people, how they influence them, what kind of moral instruction they deliver. I stop with those things. These are the great books, ideas, artworks of civilization. And if we're going to respect our society, if we want to maintain the distinctions between vulgarity and beauty, between decency and indecency, we must draw from the great tradition. And if we don't, then we end up with a mass society, and we just have to look around, and we can see what the outcome is.
Well, let me, if I may quote the Bible for a second. In the beginning was the Word. It's not for nothing that those words, I think they're from St. John, actually, but it's not from nothing that isn't a really, the word as a concept in the biblical terms isn't sort of keep coming up. And that is because it offers us literacy. And literacy, as E.D. Hirsch would say, offers us more power, because the ability to form sentences is also ability to form thoughts. And you as a teacher know this better than I do, but I just noticed I've interviewed my career as a journalist, I've interviewed murderers, rapists, and worse, if there is such a thing as worse. Liars, I think, are sort of pretty far down, but that ability to form concepts based on words is a sort of a very basic form of gain, as E.D. Hirsch learned from his appendix in his book, what every successful American needs to know. There was a storm of controversy over that. Who is he to tell us what we should know? But that reminds me actually of an appearance. We were both at an AEI conference in D.C. once, and I forgot the exact topic, but I remember you stood to condemn California's release of a book list, a recommended book reading list of 3,000 books.
That's right. That's a recommended book list. 3,000 books were on there. And what is that a sign of? That is a sign of educators who have no confidence in themselves. They have no confidence in their culture. They have no confidence in the tradition. They it's all wide open then. As opposed to people in the sciences and math, they have all the confidence in the world in an accumulative and coherent, progressive, and narrow curriculum.
But it goes deeper than that, and I think, and that's Dewey. It's Dewey, who I'm not an expert on, but I've read enough of him to know that he won. And he won in his, I mean, teachers love him. My experience is public school teachers love Dewey. He's the godfather of what they believe is the best form of education. But the problem with, as I understand Dewey was a pupil of Rousseau, and E.D. Hirsch is magisterial in his tracing of education mores from Rousseau And it just must be read by, if you haven't read Cultural Literacy, you've got to read it because it's just, as I said, a magisterial history of education. But the point is that that was the beginning of this, the beginning of what this, the truth resides in individuals. The noble savage was Rousseau's testament. The we children learn best from knowing themselves and experimenting with the world by experiencing the world on their own. This was the beginning of the guide, the teachers being a guide on the side instead of the, help me.
Sage on the stage.
Yes, sage on the stage. So you're right. We gave up of this, the idea of sage, because after all, nobody has any exclusive rights to something called the truth. And I continually experience this, and when I go to classrooms and, you know, all over the country, and it is infected now with the law. With the loss of the nuns, public school educated teachers are now in Catholic schools.
Well, I was going to say this is something the Catholic schools should not have a problem with, because you do have tradition. You do have the authoritative figures, the authoritative works, and you have the word.
I'm not so sure you're right, but that's part of the crisis myself. From what I didn't go after that in my 2007 piece, but it wasn't a big thing in my piece. But boy, I felt it that the nuns were gone, and with the nuns being gone, you lost discipline or the belief in discipline. You had already lost the sense that there being a truth, or that there is even a difference between book number one on the California list and book number 2,599.
This is the problem, the lack of differentiation, the lack of hierarchy, the failure to distinguish the great, the first rate from the third rate. And
well, Brick actually said the Catholics benefit. They would have tanked much sooner had they had money. He said because they didn't have the money, they couldn't afford to hire teachers teaching all of these 1,001 different subjects, the so-called cafeteria style curriculum that we public schools have been practicing for the last 20 or 30 years.
Now Peter, did you run into people who favored the Catholic schools solely on the achievement grounds? That is, this Catholic school is going to prepare my son or daughter for college and get me into a better school. They'll take Latin, which means their SAT verbal score is going to go up 100 points. And the discipline, the focused study will serve them well when they're on their own in freshman year.
Well, there's two things. First, you have to First is the problem of the Catholic school curriculum being lost in this whole anti-religion, religiosity world that we live on now. So that Catholic, you no longer send your kid to you do send them. We've lost the curriculum, the Latin. I don't think, I don't know the numbers, but my guess is that you won't find a lot of Catholic schools teaching Latin anymore. I mean, you'll find a few, but Catholic schools, here's one stat that was accurate and when I did this story in 2007. In the 60s, about 3% of all kids that went to Catholic, most of these stats apply to K-12 education. 3% of the kids in Catholic schools were non-Catholic.
3%, that's all? 3%,
that's all. Now, as of 2007, it was 14%. So that was part of the, already that impact. Mm-hmm. People seeking, you know, and it was good. It helped pay the bills, I'm sure. It made a lot of people mad. I know some of them whose kid couldn't get into the local Catholic school because the seats were going to Jews and Presbyterians who wanted their kid to get into the quote unquote good school. So
I wonder what the stat is now. I bet it's higher.
I bet it's got to be higher. I would think it's higher. part, and it was something that was embraced by, even in 2007, and earlier than that, there was a bishop in Washington, D.C., you probably remember his name, back in the 80s, who saw this crisis coming, and he raised money to revive the Catholic schools in D.C., which were like all kinds of schools all over the inner cities were closing like crazy. I mean, mm-hmm. the stats are really remarkable. And he launched a program which he raised money from outside the Catholic Church and pumped it into reviving Catholic schools that were closing and then opening, not just allowing non-Catholics to come in, but opening them up and going after and recruiting poor black inner city kids to come to Catholic schools, offering mm-hmm. scholarships. And his motto, which was a lovely one that was embraced by a number of people trying to save Catholic schools, we educate poor children because we are Catholic, not because they are Catholic. And that, mm-hmm. that stimulated, I think, launched what is, I think, the new phase of the Catholic education. And I think New York is a perfect example. A friend of ours from the Fordham Foundation, Ms. Porter McGee, Catherine Porter McGee, is heading up a partnership of Catholic schools and raising money privately, and I think that's beginning, those kinds of things, along with tax credits and vouchers, are beginning to take hold. But my guess is that the stats are still not good.
Peter, we have to have you back in 5 years to give us a progress report.
Then maybe I'll write something where I can actually give a decent progress report.
We should get you in the magazine and on the website on these things. So anyway, thank you for joining us.
Terrific. Thanks, Mark. Thank you.